You are not supposed to start a sermon with a disclaimer. They taught me that in seminary, but there's an exception to every rule. So let me start with this. This is a lot bigger than 20 minutes. It's more complicated and more nuanced and more difficult than 20 minutes. It's bigger than one book on the subject and bigger than one city, one department, one politician. It is a big, complicated problem. And so today it's my purpose to encourage and provoke you into learning more about this. I hope you will read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and after you read that, I hope you will keep reading and talking to folks and learning more, and then I hope you will start acting and start doing and start working. So that's the disclaimer. Now the story. We're painting with big, broad brushes here, but here's the story of America and its racial caste system. In the early colonial period and in the early republic, slave owners and those who profited from slave labor, including northern textile manufacturers and ship owners, the wealthy elites, they created a twofold narrative to justify and protect not just the institution of slavery, but their power over less wealthy whites. Part of this narrative was about the supposed natural inferiority of black people, that black folks weren't really people at all. All kinds of pseudoscience and pseudo-religion was used to make this narrative stick. The shape of the head proves it, or they're children of Ham who God punished forever. It's written in the account of Genesis. Part two of this narrative was what we now call the racial bribe, that poor whites got to have someone below them on the ladder, that whiteness itself became a source of power and privilege, at least compared with slaves. Not that working class whites got as much power as the elites, not even close. And indeed, the elites convinced the working class whites that their white privilege was tenuous, that if the slaves rose up or were freed, then they, the slaves, would take their jobs and their women. This narrative, this scheme, kept power in the hands of the elites. It diffused the most serious threat to their power, a multiracial coalition who might demand the restructuring of power and land, who might demand equality and freedom for everyone. It worked for a while, this scheme, but then it stopped working. Why? Well, partly because religious white folks, including a lot of Unitarians and Universalists, as well as Quakers and Congregationalists, found the system of slavery to be morally repugnant. They read their Bible, and they preached the truth that all men are brothers, that all people have dignity. Julia Ward Howe, a Unitarian, wrote the book that told a real story and the story of violence and oppression, and people's eyes were opened, and a multiracial coalition rose up to challenge slavery. The tyrants reached the limit of endurance of those whom they oppressed. Unitarians and Universalists in this church, including the minister at the time, Augustus Conant, spoke out against slavery and served in the war that followed. Now it took that bloody and horrific war to finally bring the South to heel, and not everyone who supported the Union believed in racial justice. Indeed, a lot of the abolitionists themselves didn't really believe that black folks were equal to white folks, but they found slavery to be a bridge too far. And for a few years, things were radically different. During the Reconstruction period, blacks got to vote, and there were a lot of them in the South, and African Americans were elected to the U.S. Senate and governor's mansions, and the whole structure of power was starting to change. Elites panicked. And what they invented and enforced through violence was Jim Crow, a system of segregation and violence so severe, so all-encompassing, that it would last for 80 years before another multiracial, religiously led coalition would rise up and defeat it. Jim Crow was premised on the same twofold narrative. First, that black folks were not really human in the same way as white folks, that they were inferior. Pseudoscience and pseudo-religion were used again. The image of the black man as dangerous, violent, lecherous, which was a central element of slavery mythology, this image was promoted, and the whole system was undergirded by the real violence, which was the KKK and a massive lynching campaign. And the second part of the narrative was used too, the racial bribe, telling working class whites that we had to keep black folks separated and segregated to protect white folks, to protect their schools, their neighborhood, their culture, their women. Jim Crow existed formally in the South and informally in the North as blacks migrated away from the South to the North and found more freedom than they had known, but they also found strict residential segregation in these northern cities, the creation of underserved ghettos with few jobs and lousy schools and poor policing. Again, a multiracial coalition rose up to challenge this system. Religious leaders said everyone is brother, is sister, and we are all human. A mass movement challenged the system. Once again, many of the white leaders in this movement were Unitarians, including James Reeb, who answered the call of Dr. King to march in Selma and was murdered by white supremacists, beaten to his death. Including the Unitarian Church in Greensboro, North Carolina, who offered their support to the sit-in movement in 1954, the first white congregation in the South to do so. Unitarians in this church supported efforts to end the informal Jim Crow that existed in Rockford. You worked to desegregate housing and to desegregate schools to try and cross the boundaries between races. And the system of legal segregation came to an end. Laws which explicitly restricted the freedom of people of color were repealed, and folks won the right to vote, and a black middle class slowly started to rise. Little girls like Grace could dream of being Peter Pan or president or anything at all. That promise of her Nana was not an empty promise. We entered an age of formal color blindness, that everyone was equal under the law, and in which it is no longer socially acceptable to harbor racial prejudice. But even as the era of Jim Crow was ending, elites and the powerful were creating a new narrative to hold onto power. Again, fear was used to justify the consolidation of power, political power in particular. This new system was formally race neutral. It said the words about color blindness, but it has created a new racial caste system. This is the system of mass incarceration. The watchwords in this system are law and order, and crime prevention, and war on drugs. In this system, millions of young black and brown men are placed under the control of the criminal corrections system and then excluded from mainstream society, unable to find work, get help, or participate in civic life. The system of mass incarceration depends on the same twofold narrative as slavery and Jim Crow. First, the stereotypes and fears about black folks. The myth that young black men in particular are more likely than not to be criminals, that they are violent, shifty, and out to take your wallet, your car, your women. The creation of a creature for us to fear. The young urban black male. the gangsta, the hood in the hoodie. The creation and maintenance of this stereotype was the essential work of the early years of the war on drugs, but the foundation of it goes back to slavery. And second, the racial bribe. That yes, we'd let some blacks move into your neighborhood and apply for some jobs, but we'd keep the criminals out. We'd keep them isolated and apart. Part of the racial bribe this time was an opportunity for blame shifting. That the problems in our country were caused by welfare queens and crack babies, and not the result of the consolidation of political and economic power, or the erosion of infrastructure or globalization. The racial bribe has always carried an implicit threat. Don't complain. It could be worse. You could be black. So let's talk about the system of mass incarceration. What's this all about? What is it? Michelle Alexander isn't the first to describe the system, but she's crystallized it and explained how it works as a totality. She identifies three stages of the system. First, the roundup. I'm quoting here. Vast numbers of people are swept into the criminal justice system by the police, who conduct drug operations primarily in poor communities of color. The police are rewarded in cash through drug forfeiture laws and federal grant money for rounding up as many people as possible. Police can stop, interrogate, and search anyone they choose, and police are allowed to use race as a factor in selecting whom to stop and search. That ends the quotation. Now, it's important to clear up some myths and confusions. First, and most important, white folks use illegal drugs in the same percentage as black and brown folks. The same percentage. It is not true that black and brown folks get arrested for drugs more because they use more. It's just not true. Study after study after study proves it. White teens are more likely to be drug dealers and more likely to go to the emergency room for drug-related events, and yet black teens are 9 times more likely to be arrested for drugs. Also, most people who get arrested for drugs are not dealers. They're not kingpins. They're users. Some are addicted. Some are having fun. Some are self-medicating because they don't have health insurance and can't afford Xanax or Prozac or Ritalin. Some aren't users at all, but their boyfriends are, or their roommates, but they too go to jail. Michelle Alexander asks us to consider an alternative universe. What if, at the beginning of the war on drugs back in the early 80s, the decision was made that we needed to use extraordinary police power to crack down on drugs on campus? What if SWAT teams were busting in dorm room doors in the middle of the night? What if college students who had an ounce of marijuana under their bed got sentenced to 5 years in jail? What if police officers busted into suburban McMansions, tearing the place apart looking for illegal painkillers? Would the war on drugs continue? No, of course not. Of course not. Does this mean that white folks aren't caught up in the war on drugs? No, it doesn't mean that either. Michelle Alexander calls them collateral damage. She points out that in some states, including right here in Illinois, 90% of the people sentenced to prison for a drug offense are African American. 90%. And she writes this: if 100% of the people arrested and convicted for drug offenses were African American, the situation would provoke outrage. We know very well that Latinos, Asian Americans, and whites also commit drug crimes. We as a nation seem comfortable with 90%, but if the figure were 100%, the veil of color blindness would be lost. The inclusion of some whites in the system of control is essential for preserving the image of a colorblind criminal justice system, and maintaining our self-image as fair and unbiased people. Hear that well, the veil of color blindness. Our criminal justice system is formally colorblind, but its effect disproportionately harms African Americans, especially poor African Americans. Colorblindness has not become equality, but willful blindness, where anyone who talks about racial justice is called a racist for even bringing it up. Phase one is the roundup. Phase two is the period of formal control. Poor defendants are assigned to overworked and underpaid public defenders. Prosecutors load up the defendants with extra charges to frighten them and get a quick plea deal. If those arrested for drug offenses on principle en masse refused to accept a plea deal and insisted on a jury trial, our criminal justice system would collapse. It would fall apart. But juries, like the rest of society, have been trained to see not normal, imperfect human being who makes mistakes like we all do, but instead trained to see the social construction, criminal blackmail, one word, one thing. Though they plead out, the folks rounded up under the system are still subject, more often than not, to mandatory minimums, multi-year sentences for first-time non-violent drug offenses are common. Phase three is what Michelle Alexander calls the period of invisible punishment. These folks are now labeled criminals, and criminals are the one group you can still legally discriminate against. They are denied the right to vote, serve on juries in many states. They must disclose their criminal past no matter what they did or how long ago when applying for jobs, and as you'd expect, are rejected out of hand by almost every employer. Criminals are denied public housing, welfare, student financial aid, and everything else that a person needs to get ahead or change your life around. So some kid makes a mistake. We all do. But they get caught up in the prison system. They spend years in prison and are released with $10 and a bus ticket to, say, Rockford. They check in with a parole officer when they get here who says, you have to get a job. Having a job is a condition of your parole. If you don't have a job, you're going back to jail. But they can't get a job because they have a criminal record. They can't afford a place to live, and they can't go back to school because they have no money, and they can't get a loan or even a Pell Grant. So what do you expect will happen? As Michelle Alexander says, it's amazing that so many who get released from formal control do go on to live lives with good work and social respect and not reoffend. That's the system of mass incarceration as Michelle Alexander describes it. There's more to it, of course, a lot more. Remember the disclaimer, there's more than 20 minutes here. The book is 200 and some pages. The problem is big and complicated, and one could despair. But you could have said the same thing about slavery and Jim Crow. Big and complicated, and one could despair. But both those racial caste systems were overturned. They were overturned by multiracial, multi-religious coalitions, people who were brave and courageous and visionary, people who sacrificed sometimes their very lives and prayed and wrote and spoke and organized. Creating this multiracial, multi-religious coalition may be really hard this time. People are hesitant about being on the side of criminals. Black clergy leaders are rightly concerned about violence in their neighborhoods, and many actually support tough-on-crime approaches, even though treatment is more effective, and the focus on drug users actually takes resources, police time and prosecutor time and jail space away from fighting violent crime. It will be hard, but it is the hard things that are worthy of us. When slavery was ended, a key part of the coalition were Unitarians and Universalists. We provided legitimacy and leadership and intellectual heft to those movements. When Jim Crow was ended, a key part of the coalition were Unitarians and Universalists. We provided support and credibility and bodies for the march. So we know if the system of mass incarceration will change, it will change in part because of us, because we will provide leadership and vision and credibility, not by ourselves, but yes, it is partly up to us. We are critical to this because just as in the previous struggles, because our theology, our values insist that all people have dignity. All people, slaves or not, segregated or not, criminal or not. All people are part of one human family. We believe that. We always have. And we are called now, as always, to make that value real. I take my sense of how spirit works from Taoism. And I take my sense of how we know what's real in the world from humanism, and I take my ethics from the prophets of the Hebrew and Christian faith. From Isaiah, who said, God has anointed me to release the prisoners, set free the captives. From Joshua Bar Joseph, a carpenter's son from Nazareth, who said, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. No one is perfect. Everyone makes mistakes. We who are called to the work of justice are called to understand the meaning of the word justice, that the punishment fits the crime and no more, that it restores, not destroys, that one's humanity, one's dignity is never lost, no matter what we've done or been accused of doing, and that all people deserve the chance to live out their dreams. Ending a racial caste system doesn't just involve changing policies. It also involves changing hearts. I don't know if I've changed any hearts today, but if I've provoked you into, as Andrew said in the chalice lighting, being willing to think about this some more, to learn more and discover more, then that'll do. That'll do nicely. As you learn, as you listen, as we share what we have learned with the world, which is the most important thing for us to do, may the hearts of those in power and the hearts of those in fear be changed too. One of the hearts changed 200 years ago was the captain of a slave trading ship, a man named John Newton. And he was convinced that he had sinned. And he changed his heart and his life. And years later, he wrote a hymn. He described the joy of having been changed. And may we have the courage to follow our conscience, to live our values, and if need be, to change our hearts. For that grace, for that life of justice, is amazing. Let's sing together and rise in body and or in spirit, and the words are up here.